appropriate for them. And when a person gets stuck in the hospital, that means that the state is not making community services available for them so that they can get out and get better. Yeah. So the U.S. Department of Justice said, well, we're going to take that seriously. We're going to go do enforcement actions. So they came back to Oregon right around 2009 and said, we're back and we're going to look at your community system and how people can get services that they need. And that started an investigation and findings that, again, the state of Oregon was violating the ADA rights of people in the hospital and that the state needed to make changes.
And so the first time when Senator Avell Gordley wrote the letter, that was, do you know what year that was? Do you know around what time that was?
I'm thinking around 2005.
Okay, so about 2005. And that's like a couple of decades after Reagan actually started like closing mental health hospitals, right? And pushing people into community services.
Well, they were pushing people out of hospitals into nothing.
Nothing, right, right. Because, but there was supposed to be this, on the other end, these community services, right?
At the same, well, back in the Reagan years, and I'm old enough to remember.
Sad but true, I am too.
Not only did he push people out of services, but he threw people off of SSI. So there were thousands and thousands of people with psychiatric disabilities who had been receiving at least some money that all of a sudden were totally cut off. So then you saw the spike in homelessness that we still are grappling with today.
Right. And we can talk about that later, whether or not the homelessness is exacerbated by a whole bunch of other stuff that's going on today. And so in 2009, they came back and they said they were going to do an investigation.
Correct.
And that was like right around the time, 2010 actually in Portland was probably the year that we had like four people killed by Portland police. And so 2011 was when they started investigating Portland police. But of course, when they were doing the Portland police investigation, they said, oh, but we're doing this mental health, which is going to feed nicely into what we're doing in Portland, and they're going to all be this nice, seamless system. We can talk about how successful we've been at that. And so when they came in 2009, they did a letter. Right? A letter of, or did they actually file with the court, with the federal court?
No, they never did file with court. In fact, what happened was that, and these things take time. You know how the Department of Justice works.
Yes.
Very slowly.
Yes.
So they completed their investigation. They presented their findings to the state. And they said, if we can't sit down together and fix this and have what's called a consent decree, something in court that says you agree to do things, we're going to fight it out in court. As I understand it, what happened was that then-Governor Kitzhaber went back to Washington and had some meetings with folks in the administration and basically said, look, I'm really on the forefront of healthcare reform. I really support the Affordable Care Act, and we're doing everything in Oregon that you want us to do. Mm-hmm. Don't take us to court. Let us fold in mental health reforms into our broader healthcare reform efforts and give us some time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, they cut a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so what has happened since then is we've embarked upon years of discussions between the Department of Justice and the state about what that deal should look like and how it should be implemented. So the letter, the original letter that kind of set all this out, came out in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you something interesting about this is that the first thing the Department of Justice said is that, we really What we would like you to do is to improve your services so that people can get out of the hospital and get good services. And we have ways to keep people from going there in the first place.
Right.
However, your data is so bad that we don't know what, in fact, you are providing in communities.
Right.
And that was so wonderful for us advocates, because for years we would go to the legislature looking for more resources. And the legislators, reasonably, and you've been there,
right.
would say, well, can you tell us what we're buying with this money?
Right.
And the state offices could never do that because they never measured it. All they measured was how much they were billed for services and how much they paid.
Right.
So they just didn't know.
Right.
And so the first thing that happened was that the federal government and the state agreed that the state would try to come up with some better data to show what they're doing.
Right.
That literally took 2 years just to get to the place where both of the parties could agree that there was something meaningful to measure. And so you could create, by having some data, you could say, okay, this is where we are now.
Right.
Let's talk about where we want to be. So, gee, we're now, it's 2016, we're 4 years down the road, and we still don't have a signed agreement.
I can't help but wonder what impact our less than perfected healthcare transition plan played in this, right? Is that giving the federal government, I guess are they being polite because they know we're fixing the system that really was screwed up, that was supposed to be a national model and never worked? Maybe that's why they've given them more time. But as I look at the report, it's clear that still today, so they've been at this for 4 years, it is clear at looking at this, the most recent letter, which was dated March 11th of this year, of last year, that... they still can't answer some basic questions about service, like who's getting this service, and they've given them some very specific categories that they're looking at, and you know, lots of wonderful acronyms like the ACT, the Assertive Community Treatment Services, Mobile Crisis Services. They talked about a model, which I believe was in Marion County, that actually the sheriff and the police and the DA and community service providers look for opportunities to get people into community supports rather than trying to put them in a state hospital or something of that sort. And so they talk about supportive housing, but I don't know that supportive housing is on anybody's agenda, right? And they identify a supportive housing as being housing that allows people to live independently, normally one or two people, but with their own bedroom, and they sign a lease just like anybody else that would sign a lease. But of course, they would be paying based on their income. And then the services that they needed would be provided either on site or at some other location, but the services would not be mandated. And so they talk about these really great, wonderful opportunities that could really serve our community well. But right now, they look like they're just a wish on paper, unless we actually have some of these somewhere that I don't know about.
Well, I think what we have now is we have bits and pieces of these things in different places. And so there's some good models out there. But it's not available all over the state, very much not available in rural areas, and it's quite spotty. Plus, we're overwhelmed. We don't have the resources to deal with the need, and what that means is what's happening today. And let me just tell you about what's happening today.
Okay.
So the things you talked about are all about trying to deal with folks who are in crisis. And you know from the Portland police situation that a lot of the contacts between police and people with psychiatric disabilities in the community happen at points in crisis. And when the police come into contact with a person, because of the way we have things structured now, police officer has two choices. They can take the person to an emergency room or they can take a person to jail.
Right.
And if they go to an emergency room now, emergency room. They'll go into a little room, and it's called boarding. They'll stick a person in a little room all by themselves, which is like not the best thing to do if you're in a psychiatric crisis.
That's right.
And a person could stay there for days, or you end up in jail, which is probably the worst place you can be.
That's right.
If you have a psychiatric crisis. So folks recognize that, at least in the mental health field. And so the idea is, well, how does a police officer have another alternative? How can we have folks recognized to be in mental health crisis, get them into treatment, and not only treatment, but then an opportunity to then step into other services that can help them to avoid being in crisis in the future, rather than what's happening right now. And I'm going to explain what's happening right now, because it's a real problem, is that the state hospital is being flooded with people who are coming from the criminal courts, who are found not to be able, what's called, to aid and assist their lawyer.
Right, in their defense.
And so if they're mentally unable to defend themselves, they can be sent by a judge to the state hospital. And what's happening more and more is that people are getting picked up for misdemeanors, small little nuisance crimes, or things that happen when a person's in psychiatric crisis.
Right.
And they're being sent off to the hospital. There's just a flood of those now, so that our state hospital is opening up new wards. It's putting people in beds that are designed for other types of people, because people in communities have recognized that this is a way to get folks into the state hospital. The second big problem with that, not only of overburdening our resources, is that when they get stabilized, where do they get sent back to?
To jail.
To jail. Worst place to be. And then if their charges, as they often are, dismissed because they've spent plenty of time, do they then step off into community mental health services, housing, and supports that they need?
No.
They're just off
released to the street.
So we've got a dysfunctional system. And it's very disheartening that after 4 years of negotiations with all these really good things that you've talked about, because folks really do know how to address these problems.
Yes.
There's really successful models out there that we have only been able to implement them in a spotty way across the state. And we end up with people suffering in jail cells. I could tell you stories about people in jail cells that are just very upsetting for anyone. And so can sheriffs around the state tell you those stories.
Well, I mean, and it's troubling to think that we have now built a system where the first person someone suffering a mental health crisis may interact with is law enforcement, which is, I have to say, the last person, if you're in crises, you're in a mental health crisis that you really want to see, unless you're absolutely sure you've got that officer, right, that's been well-trained in how to engage people who are suffering from mental health issues. But it's always, if you call 911, it is the luck of the draw. You don't know who's going to show up. You don't know what their attitude's going to be. And I've always thought it was weird that we would put people in jail for petty things like urinating on the sidewalk or littering or loitering, when we know that the real issue is that they have a mental health issue. Right. And it just has always boggled my mind why it's so expedient to be able to just like put them in jail out of sight, out of mind, as if they're not going to get out again, and then have the same situation that becomes more exacerbated. Well, for our listeners, if you're just joining us, I am talking with Bob Jundep, and he is the executive director of Disability Rights Oregon. Mm-hmm. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. So I guess this is always the big question. Is it getting better?
In some ways it is.
And in some ways? In some ways it's not.
You know, sometimes when you can see ways for it to be better, it's even more frustrating when it's not getting there. So here in Portland, some folks are working on building something called the Unity Center.
Yes, yes.
And you know about that legacy.
Maybe you can answer system. A question about the yeah. Unity Center, because yeah. one of the things that I'm unclear about, yeah. It's being presented to the public as this crisis center, right? Mm-hmm. That anybody who's suffering a mental health issue can be able to go in and get triaged and kind of figure out what's going on. But is that true? Do you have to have healthcare with one of those healthcare agencies that are building a Unity Center? Or is it just they will serve anyone who comes in the door?
Well, you know, like a lot of things, we'll see what it really looks like.
We'll see. Right?
It's modeled after a program in Oakland, California, that has been considered to be pretty successful. It's got its problems, as mm-hmm. I understand it. And I know the folks who are working on putting together the Unity are trying to address the main criticism of that program is that they tend to, when they let people go, they just kind of send them out.
Uh-huh.
And it's called BART therapy, I think. Uh-huh. But a big issue for the successful operation of that type of crisis center is how will people be stepped off into the community. A lot of times people go into a mental health crisis because what's happening in the community. So sending them back into the exact same situation isn't really dealing with the problem.
That's right.
But so there's going to have to be a very good linkage between the Unity Center and the community providers. And they're going to have adequate housing options and mobile services that can help those folks recover from their crisis.
Right.
So that's a big question. Another big question is just what they call capacity.
Right.
We had something called the Triage Center in Portland probably about 10 years ago. I lose track of time.
Right.
That was operated by Providence, and it just became overwhelmed.
Oh.
The idea at that time was that the police would be able to drop people off who mm-hmm. were in crisis, and then the triage center would try to figure out where they needed to go.
Right.
Nobody was happy with that except the police. Mm. It was convenient for the police because they had a one-stop
place
to bring folks. They became overwhelmed with numbers. The people who went there were unhappy. Someone referred to it as Fort Apache to me because it was just so intense.
Out of control.
And financially, it didn't work out, as I understand it. So the new model that they're talking about is really built upon a structure where they will try to turn most of the people who come there around within a 24-hour window, and there will be a lot of what we call peer support, people mm-hmm. with lived experience of mental health issues who can relate to folks and help work with them to figure out what's going on and what they may need. You know, one of the things in mental health, and it's still a struggle today, it's still a political debate, even in Washington,
right.
Is that there's a group of folks, and I think here in Oregon we're pretty much aligned with this, who understand that in order to have successful services, you have to listen to the people who are getting the services
right.
and figure out what they're saying and what they need.
Right.
Then there's a whole other group who think that if you have a major mental illness, you don't know what's best
what
for you, and
mm.
somebody else has to take control and make you do things. I think Oregon has moved away from that model, although again in Washington, D.C., there's a real effort to push that mm-hmm. model by some. There's a just sidelight. There's a bill in Congress. Most people call it the Murphy Bill, and named after a representative from Pennsylvania.
Right.
And his idea is that federal mental health monies and services should be more that father knows best type of approach. Some of our local legislators, like Representative Blumenauer and Representative DeFazio have signed on to bill those bills. We're hoping that they understand that while it's good to have more resources coming into the system and more support, that this kind of authoritarian approach hasn't really proven to be successful. So that's one of the ongoing debates that are going on right now on the national level.
Right.
So anyway, just to bring it back home, though, what we need to do is we need to get this agreement with the state concluded. We need to get some benchmarks in place so that we can have more well-funded and community mental health services that deal with crisis, that get people the services they need in the community, that help keep them out of jail, and that allow them to get the treatment they need in their communities rather than being sent off somewhere to some big building in Salem or Junction City.
Right. I was just going to ask you about Junction City, because that's where the new state hospital is being built. Is that right?
Yeah, it's actually it's been completed.
Oh, and it's
finished. And there are people there.
How many beds is that hospital, do you know?
Oh,
I could probably look it up.
I think it's about 100 and somewhere in the area of 150, not exactly.
And relation to the old state hospital, what was the capacity there? Do you remember?
Well, the hospital in Salem has 620 beds.
Okay.
Very big hospital, and it was unusual in that nationally, states have moved away from building very large state
facilities,
hospitals,
right?
But Oregon decided to go that direction.
And where is Junction City?
Junction City is just north of Eugene.
North of Eugene. Okay.
It's where 99W and 99E come together.
Ah, okay. Okay. I wondered about that. We have a caller on the line. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. Good morning, Catherine. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Joanne. I wanted to say that personally, I and my family have experienced a lot of the things that Bob has mentioned, psychiatric boarding, inability to access services in the community, watching two of my sons spiral into scary suicidal types of behavior, and ending with reaching out for help to a crisis team in Washington County, which resulted in the arrest and rapid criminalization of my young son, who spent 361 days in and out of the state hospital until his case was finally adjudicated. And he's been recommitted under the PSRB since June 5th. But now all of the things that we've been through up to now have been horrendous, but now I'm truly fearful for his safety. I feel that he is, instead of being treated to have a life, to be well, to be able to actualize some joy or, you know, sense of future, he's being put through, trying to be put through procedures and programs that he cannot comply with because of his illness, and he's not in a place where he can advocate for himself.
Right.
I have tried to reach out to Disability Rights of Oregon. They tell me the only way to get anybody to investigate is for him to make a complaint, but he's so full of despair right now, he can't even copy down a phone number. Mm. I'm literally terrified with what's going on, and I don't know what to do.
So I'm going to ask our engineer to take your phone number, so stay on the phone, but I want to give Bob an opportunity to see if he has a comment. And first, I just want to say I am so sorry that you're having this experience and your sons are having this experience, but this is exactly what we've been talking about today, about how we criminalize illness as a matter of course in this country and specifically in the state of Oregon. And so, Bob, any advice for this mom?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to share my I'm at a loss for words.
Yeah, right.
I hear stories like this so often, and it's frustrating, and it's frustrating to be an advocacy organization and to understand that the way that we have things structured right now really limits the remedies that a person can look to for ways to address it. I mean, it's a situation, and again, this is not. There are many people who are stuck in this situation in which the way that we have things structured between the criminal law system and the mental health system and the resources that it's like a Franz Kafka novel. You just get stuck in it, and it doesn't offer what people need. In my fantasy world, I would scrap it all and go back and put something together that actually addressed people's needs. Mm-hmm. And we're just not there. So, I feel like sometimes we are in a situation as advocates of saying to folks, it's a horrible situation, but everything is structured in such a way that it just isn't designed to meet the needs that people have.
Of the individuals, it's got to be really, really frustrating for family members who, as this mom is saying, I've done everything I can to try to get them services and help. And of course, after they get to a certain age, you're even kind of prohibited from talking to the parents about what's taking place with them if he doesn't give permission for you to have a conversation with the service provider, right? Because of privacy laws around health services.
You know, one of the things that we worked with Representative Kenny Geyer and other advocates and family groups was to clarify those those confidentiality HIPAA, uh-huh. laws. We certainly have confidentiality laws, but there's certain exceptions for them, and that many times providers don't understand. And so, actually, in the last legislature, we passed a bill that said in state law, oh, by the way, here is an exception to the confidentiality laws that's in federal law. We're putting it into state law just to remind you that it's there. And that is one that allows for sharing of information with caregivers who will have a responsibility to provide care for folks when they're being discharged from a facility.
Wow.
It has some very specific provisions. So, I mean, it's respectful of people's privacy, but it recognizes that when an individual is relying upon a family member or a caregiver for help, they need information in order to give them the help that they need.
Right.
So this has been in federal law all the way along, but people don't understand it. So these are the types of things that just educating ourselves about what the real rules are can help, not necessarily solve a problem, but help a family to cope with a situation.
Right. Are you still there?
Oh, yeah, I'm still here.
So does your son have health care? Is he covered?
Well, there are laws that prohibit Medicaid from paying for in-hospital psychiatric care, which is another whole but what happens with people at the state hospital is often they come out with these enormous bills that ruin their credit, and if they ever have any assets, they're attached. But if they don't, then of course they can't pay them, but they owe them.
What do you mean they come out of the state hospital with enormous bills?
Well, I've known of several people who came out with it. It's right on their website. They want you to pay if you have the ability, and then if you don't have the ability when you come out, if you have means later on, they follow you around and try to get some of that money back.
Really?
I mean, the whole thing is, it is Kafkaesque. It is like Orwellian. It is more, I mean, it is terrifying, though, now, because people who do not know my son and who do not seemingly, not all of them care about him, and he did sign a HIPAA waiver, it's not a question of them not talking to me. It's a question of making a concerted different effort to exclude his dad and I from his treatment plan, and then not recognizing that he's not able to comply with what they want him to do. And he had a suicide attempt last week. I'm really terrified for his safety.
And so if she was calling your office, what would you advise her to
do? They advised me yesterday to get him to call himself, and he doesn't think anybody can help him, and he can't even really focus long enough to write down a phone number.
Boy, there's so many things that have just been brought up, but let me just answer the first thing, is that we are an organization that's funded to represent individuals, and so we don't have the authority to act on anyone's behalf unless they give us direction to do so.
Mm-hmm.
We're not funded to represent from a legal standpoint, the interests of the family, even though they may be the same as the interest of the individual. Now, there are state agencies, protective services agencies that are housed in the counties that are designed to respond to complaints of abuse or neglect that are within the system. But there is inadequate. Well, the very services that we're talking about in this Department of Justice are part of that, as you talked about, the ACT teams. These are teams of mental health professionals that are supposed to be able to respond and go out into the community to engage a person who is in crisis or in need of assistance.
Mm-hmm.
According to the Department of Justice agreement, each county would be responsible for having an adequate number of those teams to deal with these types of situations. Those are not available. Let me just mention one other thing, because since we're talking about Franz Kafka, is that, yes, in Oregon, if you end up in the state hospital, federal Medicaid doesn't pay for state hospital beds for reasons we don't need to go into now. And the state will look to the person, they will bill the person for the services that they receive there, even if they don't want to be there.
That is the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard.
And they have something called a cost of care process, and they will assess a person's ability to pay, and they will bill for that. We challenged that in court maybe 20 years ago and lost. It is allowed.
That's great. So what county do you live in, ma'am?
Washington, the hellhole.
So there is a crisis, mental health crisis line in Washington.
No, Joanne, that's how this whole thing happened, is we called them for help, and instead of helping him, they brought police and arrested him.
And so there's also, are you able to transport him somewhere? Because there's an urgent walk-in clinic at 4212 Southeast Division Street.
Well, no, not now, because he's been adjudicated and he's under the PSRB for the next 5 years.
Yeah, what that means is that he used the insanity defense
he was charged
with a crime. He used the insanity defense, and when you succeed in using that defense, you get sent to the state hospital under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Their job is to decide how long you stay in the hospital. And when you get out, they're like a probation office, in that they work on housing and other types of supports, and a person's obligated to follow that regime or else they get sent back to the hospital.
And so the catch-22 that this mom is talking about, you've got a son who doesn't have the mental capacity to follow the rules that's being laid out, and then the only people that, because of his current status, that can help him are people that are only deciding whether or not you're following the rules, and if you're not, you go back in the hospital.
You see, I'll put it this way:
okay.
Is that the old way we used to do it? This is years ago. Is that if a person was in crisis, they got picked up and taken to the state hospital, where they would stay maybe for the rest of their lives, or at least for a long, long time.
Right.
That was how we did things. Then we decided to move away from that. The idea was that the types of services that this Department of Justice agreement talks about would be in place so that people could get the services they need in the community. Well, we didn't do that. So what happened was that people who go into crisis oftentimes end up in the criminal justice system. So a police officer responds to the problem. That person gets taken to the jail. They get charged with some crime that's related to their mental illness. They may do the insanity defense route, or they may do this thing where their attorney says, hey, this person can't relate to me, and they get sent to the state hospital for restorative treatment to be able to face charges. Then they'll either get let back, they'll be, the charges will be dismissed or resolved, they'll be back in the street, or they'll do jail time. So
they'll do jail time even though they've spent all the time in a mental health facility, or does the judge take into account that they've been...
You get to count that time.
Okay.
And then the other thing, I don't want to make things too miserable here, but the other thing is that, of course, if it's a serious crime, people end up in prison. And you may know about our recent agreement with the Department of Corrections about their behavioral health unit, where people who are so sick that they end up in prison and they can't survive in prison end up in this unit where they've been spending 23 hours a day in cells with 1 hour mental health treatment per week. I mean, very, very bad situation. So let me just get in another pitch.
Okay. Ma'am, I thank you so much for holding on. As you can tell, I have questioned Bob in depth, and unfortunately, it does not sound like today that either of us actually have an answer to how you can support your son. And I think that's a sad thing for us to say.
Well, if he's
at
under the
moment.
If he's
absolutely
under the
terrifying.
If he's under the PSRB, actually, there's some, I'll have to say, there are some great opportunities there because
okay, hang on then. There's
because some that gives him a right to services.
Oh, okay.
And so and this is the sad thing is that you have to
but he's
got
to be the one
far down. Well,
and he has to ask for the services.
Now, under when he's on the board, there's a lot of incentives to go with the regime and to follow through with the treatment because the goal is to get out of the hospital,
right?
Which most people want to do, and then he has the right to planning, discharge planning, and for services that he needs when he gets out. Now I can't guarantee that he will succeed in that, but unlike so many people, he actually has a structure and a right to those services once he's gotten into the situation. So that's the good news. Even it's kind of like you have to hit bottom in order to hook into a system that can get you what you need.
Right.
So we had such hope that this was going to be the thing that brought him. He's only 20, by the way, that brought him back to some semblance of wellness. And it's so scary and just it's terrifying. It's I don't even know. I'm apoplectic thinking about what could happen to him there. It's not a caring system, and it's not a humane system, and it needs to be changed.
So if I were you, one of the things I would do is contact my legislators, my state senator, my House member, and I would tell them the same story that you've just shared with us. And get them to make some recommendations about what you can do to support their efforts. The difference between you and I calling a state agency attempting to get service and someone that happens to be calling under the title of state representative or state senator is they get access a lot quicker than you or I would get to those decision makers. And so my advice would be to today, they're in session this month. And so today I would send a letter to my House member and Senate member, explain the situation to them, tell them that this is a potentially crisis situation because anything, you know, it could change at any moment. So just kind of share the story and then tell them you need help and see how they try to assist you in that effort.
Okay. Thank you.
You are so welcome. And again, I'm so sorry you're having this experience. And you know, I couldn't help but think of the poor family who's burying their child today
in
Clackamas County, Kananji family, who were burying their son, Chris, 19, who was shot and killed by Clackamas County Sheriff's officers. And he was having the exact same kind of crisis situation when somebody called the police for help, and ultimately they killed him. So
there, but for the grace of God go we.
That's right. That's up. And so when I heard your story, I just flashed right back to this family who called for help, and you know, and today they're burying their 19-year-old. So I hope that that doesn't happen to anyone else in our community, because it's clear we have a problem, and we're sending the wrong people out to solve that problem. Thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome. Thank you, Joanne.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
We have another call on the line. Hello, Andrew. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey, well, first off, this is more important. I just wanted to say to the last caller, you know, support your boy and just love him and don't stigmatize him like you're not. Mm-hmm. And just keep in touch with him every day and be strong for him, you know, set a good example and just reassure him that everything's going to be okay, that you're all going to get better together. And that that's the most important thing for a person suffering from mental health is their support group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you admit any weakness in mental health in our society, you're instantaneously stigmatized on a level that even it's very taboo in our society. So even criminals are looked outright felon criminals are looked at better than mental health sufferers.
Mm.
So I just say support them and that's how you'll get better on a personal level and move forward. Society, you can't, you know.
Well, thank you so much for your call. It sounds like you are the voice of experience.
Well, so my call actually was for, I'm originally from the coast and I live in Portland now. Well, they've defunded the schools so much that a lot of even the most intelligent people start suffering from mental health issues, and when they kind of look to society for help, they are instantaneously stigmatized, removed, and I've had multiple friends sent to the state hospital, and I think it's really odd that we will write a blank check to the prison system for, you know, felons and for all kinds of just disgusting criminals. But for honest people having a, you know, outcry for help, they simply don't know what's going on in their head. We'll just lock them away, throw away the key, and then charge them and call them all kinds of just disgusting things just because we don't want to deal with, you know, humanity coming into the 21st century, basically. But I think if we wrote a blank check for schools at a basic level and charged everybody that wanted to do crime, the entire world would be a lot better place very quickly.
So I just want to challenge your assumption of criminality.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are a lot of people in prison and jails for a whole lot of reasons, right? You know, I guess if we were going to do a study today, you'd figure out 20% of people were in there because they had some mental health issue. I would think that another 20% are in there because of crimes of poverty. I would think another 20% would be in there because they made a bad decision once, you know.
Absolutely.
And so I just want to caution you there. I think we have to be compassionate. I agree with you about compassion, but compassion should go to people, whether they're in mental health crisis or whether they've committed a crime. I mean, people are not what they did on their worst day. People are much, much more than that. So thank you so much.
I think it's interesting as well, because I think better education and better funding for education would solve all of those things you listed as well.
Well, you know, too bad we only have 10 minutes left in this program, because I've been around long enough to know that when we pour bucket loads of money into education, the outcomes didn't change. And we've been crying about no money for 20 years. and the outcomes haven't changed. So that's a longer conversation, but I thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Have a great day. Okay, who else we got? Hello, Sunny. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, good morning, Joanne. Thank you for another important program, and thank you also to the fellow who's beside you. I just wanted to say I think we're clearly in a mentally ill culture society because people need connection. The family needs
yes.
help. It is hard for people to raise their children amongst so much stress. It's
yes.
hard for young people to grow up amongst so much stress. It's hard for police people to keep running around under so much stress. And I thought of a 1 cent transaction fee, you know, per purchase of maybe $100 of groceries, 1 cent added, a candy bar, 1 cent added to keep our fountains going because they're going to shut off our fountains, our beautiful fountains in the city this summer when it's going to be hot, which is going to be additionally very depressing. But what about a 1 cent transaction fee or even per, you know, whatever, to fund community centers 24-hour open so that people have a place to go, to exercise, which is so important, to socialize, a respite center for stressed parents, a connection center where you can get involved with volunteer work in the community. It's just time that we grow up and face the fact that people need nurturance, just like plants need water.
Amen. Thank you so much, thank Sunny.
You. Yeah, thank you, Joanne.
Really appreciate the call. Thank yeah. you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. I want to let folks know that on Saturday, February 13th, there is an event called One Heart, Two Men. There was the very first, you may not know this, Oregon's first successful heart donor. We're celebrating 30 years since that happened. One black, one white. You may not know this. This is an interesting story. Bob Olive Sr., this Saturday, February 13th, from 5 to 8:30 at the Stay Clean Recovery Center, located at 2601 Southeast 160th off Division. That's Saturday, February 13th, History in the Heart Celebration, One Heart, Two Men. And Bobby Olive Sr. will be honored at that event. I think we could squeak in this last phone call. Hello, Wade. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO. We're almost out of time.
Peace. Well, I can answer your questions. $25,000 a month is what OSH charges you, whether you've agreed to or not.
$25,000 a month?
Current scam. To the max. So this is what happens. You go and you refuse to spread your cheeks, and so you're considered 8 max psychiatric lockdown, 24-hour, no out time, no nothing for months. Then they send you to OSH, which is the acronym is OSH.
Now you're on the air, so you're controlling yourself. I appreciate that.
Did I just use the... Okay.
No, you're good. You were well. I was just a little worried. I get nervous because, you know...
There's a lot of information. Okay,
yes, yes.
Very quickly, but here... what they say is that you are not able to aid and assist your public depender. Poor excuse for an attorney.
So this kind of...
attorney, if you have one, free of charge, which is they do charge you later on, but they still keep telling you it's all free and all. Yeah, free to find you guilty. they're supposed to aid and assist I would think. Not me to aid and assist. You see, so like you're not playing your little game. Now you're crazy. Now you're gonna get paid. Now you're gonna pay. And see, now if I had health insurance,
and you don't have health insurance,
go and ka-ching. It's huge. And then you mentioned that there are laws that prohibit Medicaid. That was a missing piece for me for paying for such shenanigans. Why?
I'm sorry, that gentleman wasn't ready to have a conversation. He's off. But he gave me some information that I didn't know, that it costs $25,000 a month to stay at the state hospital. I will need to check on that and find out if that's accurate. But
well, you know, Joanne, it's a hospital.
It's a hospital. Right.
Think of it like any hospital where they want to move you out of there fairly quickly because it's expensive to be there.
Right.
You have all these professionals and facilities and everything. So, yeah, it's not a place where you want to just kind of go and hang out for a couple of years.
I wish that gentleman had been a little bit more coherent because I really would want to know. Because he said he's got a $75,000 debt and he doesn't have health insurance. And I'm thinking, why does he not have health insurance? So Bob, I really, really appreciate you being here today. I thank you for helping me understand what's happening at the state level with the Department of Justice. So I suspect that maybe next month, we should have an updated report about what they found since this report was released on March 11th, 2015. You would think that annually they'd be doing some kind of report about what's taking place.
You would hope so. The leaders of the Oregon Health Authority have reported to the legislature now for months that they're just on the verge of completing this agreement. And just on the verge, and that's where they still are. So we would really like them to get over the verge,
sign
the agreement, and start working on implementing it.
Yes, I certainly agree with that. And we just have to keep following up because clearly the people who've called today are just a tip of the iceberg of people who are having this experience in Oregon. And we've known that the mental health system has failed for a long time, and we have not done an effective job of actually figuring out how to get services to people at a cost they can afford at the time they need it. I also did not want the program to end without saying that Portland Police Bureau used to have a place because Multnomah County used to pay about $400,000 a year for a drop-off place for people with mental health issues, and Portland Police didn't use it for years, even though the money was there for them. And the reason they didn't use it was because they didn't want to fill out the paperwork that was associated with dropping people off. And so I think this new deal with the DOJ and the police bureau is just another one of those kind of systems that keep telling us it's going to get better, it's going to get better. Trust us. Thank you very much, Steve, for being the fabulous engineer that you are. Thank you, listening audience. I will see you next week, same time, same place, and same station. Have a fabulous day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. You don't know what life is really worth. It's not all that glitter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right.
And good morning. KBOO Portland is what you're listening to, your community radio station. Minute before 9 o'clock on your Thursday morning. We're about an hour away from Air Cascadia with Chris Andre, and then at 10:15, join us for Flashpoints. A former EPA whistleblower calls for a criminal investigation to prosecute the people who are responsible for poisoning the water supply for Flint. And a deep look at the case of Sirhan Sirhan and the murder of Robert Kennedy in 1968. At 11 on Between the Covers, Pamela Rottner Sakamoto discusses her book, Midnight in Broad Daylight, A Japanese-American Family Caught Between Two Worlds. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, Portland art duo Jacob and Arnold Pander talk about their newest project, the interactive adventure comic, The Dissident. That's all coming up, but first it is Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. Teresa Mitchell is coming up next. It's KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Youth Summit. taking place for